In this week's program, Ian Morris's book, Why the West Rules for Now, The Patterns of History and What They Reveal About the Future. The author is Professor of Classics, Professor of History, and a Fellow of the Archaeology Center at Stanford University. Up to now, he argues, the West has fared better than the East economically, mainly because of geography. But current predictions favor China taking over from the West later in the century. Morris suggests that what might make all talk of East-West competition irrelevant would be a revolutionary technology that merged mind and machine. Such a development is, in fact, predicted by the technology guru Ray Kurzweil for 2045. This would usher in the era of post-biological man and a new age of untold possibilities. On the other hand, lack of resources and an increasingly irresponsible attitude to the environment may yet spell ruin for us. With me, Paul Gillespie, a journalist who has specialised in international relations. He writes a column for the Irish Times and was formerly foreign policy editor with that newspaper. Bridget Laffan, principal of the College of Human Sciences at UCD, and Michael D. Higgins, former government minister for the Arts, Culture and the Gaeltacht. Bridget, what did you make of this rather large book?
Well, I think one can certainly say it's a big book. Whether it's a great book is another matter. It's in terms of the ambition, one has to, it's impressive, one has to admire the ambition. But I think that it's also because it seeks to tell the story of human history from 50,000 years on, then obviously it's very general. He also claims to have a theory of history, and that's where I think one begins to argue with it. He very much, it's very reductionist in that it's all about geography and brute material forces and culture, institutions, battles, all the conflicts about progress that have happened over all of these millennia. They don't seem to rate that much at all. In terms of a read, though, it's an important book. It's a book that wouldn't have been written 20 years ago. It's a book of our time, and it's a book because there now is, for the first time in over the last 250 years, the fact that China, in terms of its economic dynamism, appears in, at least at a productive level, will outstrip the West.
What did you make of it, Paul Gillespie?
I was very impressed. I was reminded all the time of the word edumacational, in that the historical sweep, he's an archaeologist, that's very central to the book. It gives that wonderful span of the sweep of history. At one stage, towards the end, he refers to Geoffrey Elton, the historian, who remarked that it was only possible to write the history of human beings over 200 generations. If you bring archaeology in, you get 500 generations. If you go back to Homo erectus, you have 25,000 generations. So that sweep, for all the reservations that Bridget has expressed, it seems to me adds the real value to the book. And I was very taken with it.
And Michael Dee, what was your reaction to this large, large tome?
Well, I found it to be an irritating book. I think that I agree with Paul, and I very much that the sweep, and Bridget as well makes the same point. I very much agree with that the sweep is impressive. But when you see a book, when you find a book written by a professor of classics, for example, I would imagine that you would find certain intellectual inclusions that are singularly missing. For example, the assumptions of Greek society. In fact, the book has a paucity of philosophical depth in it, in my view. So the range is impressive. But I also see a more serious flaw insofar as that there's a kind of geographical determinism in it, which I would reject. This is rather, just to finish that point, just the geographical determinism is, to me, reminiscent of the prejudice of the 18th century in relation to a kind of cultural determinism and cultural backwardness. So when I say I found it irritating, I kept thinking of books like Toffler's and others, those kind of irritating great sweeps that make assertions that lack a scholarly engagement with issues of ideology, philosophy, and really theoretical alternatives.
But the odd thing is the way he holds on to the term geography, when in effect he's talking about technology. In other words, he's so eager to hold on to geography, which really isn't the explanatory factor at all. He's so eager to hold on to it that he's willing to say that social development changes the meaning of geography. In other words, that's so in fact it's more technological determinism.
Well,
in fact,
curiously, his timing is very bad, because if you take, for example, the collapse of the vicious radical individualism of Aaron Rant and the kind of combination of technology with the transfer of money in real time that has brought us to the global disaster in the financial side. Yes. In a curious way, his timing is bad for arguing, as you put it, for a combination of technology and social form which might deliver us into some kind of new future. You see, he's interesting as well in relation to the bold statement he makes at the end, which I found intriguing. That, and I do agree with him in half. I go halfway in this, and it's rather like Paul's point. He suggests that archaeology may save us, but if we come to see how, if you like, civilizations have come and gone, we can get kind of a certain perspective. And then he argues that television, allied to archaeology, may create a kind of consciousness that makes us all nervous.
Him, he makes the concept of social development central. And in fact, then he attempts to operationalize that, to convert that to some kind of measuring rod. And when he does that, what he ends up with is, when you look at different societies, one measuring tool is the success the society has in extracting energy. Then its organizational capacity, state of its information processing, its capacity to make war. They're the kind of things he looks at right through all the ages. I suppose they're quite comprehensive, aren't they?
Yes and no. There's a problem with any index, and there must always be a problem with an index that seeks to track the kind of sweep that this book.
As a way of defining social development, is it?
I think it defines some of social development in that the capacity to extract energy clearly matters, information technology matters, war making capacity, but there was nothing there about individual well-being.
Yes.
At all. And for me, that's really important in terms of social development and something called progress. So I found it limited. What was also striking about the graphs was that there actually was very little change up to about 1800. It trundled along along the bottom, and that really energy capture, the explosion in energy capture happens after 1800, the 1800s, 1900s, and have accelerated since.
And just by way of a general map, what I found useful where he said was, apart from a period of 1200 years, between 541 BCE and 773 BCE, when the East was in front, the general pattern since the end of the Ice Age has been the West has been ahead. So the West... Paul, yes?
I think it's convincing there. I think those operations, the energy, the organization, the war making, have to be included in any indexation, data series.
Yeah.
I'm taking again Bridget's point about individual well-being, happiness. He tends to eschew that. He parks it. He says, I'm dealing with something that's morally neutral.
But
given that, he actually demonstrates that over the 15 millennia, the Western portion of the geography was in fact ahead, by 2,000 or 3,000 years. Mm. And in that period, only for 1 millennium was the East ahead on these measurements.
But I question that.
Well, I wonder what, I'm not in a position to question, but he uses, given the sweep, he uses this as a grid within which to have his large narrative.
What he rules out, Michael, here he's saying that really the determining factors are geography, or more properly technology. What he really rules, doesn't see a role for at all, are ideas. I mean, he sees that the ideas that prevail in a society are really a reflection of other things, namely the kind of social organisation you have and so on. I take it you would be uncomfortable with that, with the idea of ruling out a role for ideas.
I think he misses a great deal because of that. I think that, for example, he argues on towards the end, page 592, that he's the two general claims in this book, that biology, sociology and geography jointly explain the history of social development, and it goes on. Well, the problem about it is is that his neglect of thought leads him to leave out very important things. For example, does he address the assumptions of the connection between science and society? He's like, early on he argues, he poses a rhetorical question, would China have had a scientific revolution?
Yeah, but his point,
well, now, if you pose that question without asking, for example, what are the assumptions, are you talking about a scientific approach that talks about a symmetry with nature, or are you talking about Bacon's approach in the Western tradition? Mm-hmm. And I think that what he's doing is that he's smuggling in Bacon assumptions and working them backwards to other periods.
But there's
and that leads him to omit, if you like, what was the promise of very much the promise of the connections between philosophy and technology and application in the East.
There's a recurring mantra here, Bridget, and that is that each age gets the thought it deserves.
That's
so
right.
Therefore, thinking and thought ideas are always secondary. That's really what he's about, isn't it?
It is, but again, I certainly was uncomfortable with that because it viewed thought as consequence than as cause.
Yes. Yes.
And yet, if you think from the Renaissance and the consciousness of the centrality of man, all of that really did matter.
Yeah.
In terms of the political, human, sociological, societal development of our part of the world. So I just...
But the fact is it's both. I mean, it's both cause and effect.
Effect.
Yeah, yeah.
But he does... I don't want to be put in the perpetual defence of him, but he does. He sees the relationship between the Renaissance and the breakthrough of oceanic travel, the breakthrough of scientific revolutions in the 17th century. And, I mean... Where we might
But even if you look at what he calls the first wave of axial thought, that is to say, around 500-600 BCE, where you had the new thinking about religion and transcendence and so on, he's still seeing it in the context that new thinking is still a reflection of other things, namely the kind of the social organization of the society and so on.
Well, in the long sweep, he says it came. It's not surprising that it came at that point in history. Yeah, and he does compare it East and West. He compares it to Buddhist and Confucianist thought. He talks about it in several different stages. I think perhaps the archaeological discipline creates a certain kind of determinism.
Yeah, that's right.
I think at the very end, his solution at the very end to the dilemmas of our time are bring in the ideas that were perhaps absent earlier.
That's right, yeah.
And archaeology leaves you with the material.
You
begin with what's left.
But he is apocalyptic in the end.
He doesn't seem to see the glaring ludicrousness or contradiction of claiming geography as the ultimate determinant, and at the same time saying that China is going to take over, when in fact, that's his prediction more or less, isn't it, for the second half?
Let me
finish on that. He follows Martin Jakes, whose book you and I, Paul, discussed on this program, and follows Jakes in saying that in the first half of the 21st century you'll see a Chinese rise, and thereafter what?
Well, he says that thereafter there has to be a transcendence of geography. He talks about a singularity. He talks about a need for global solutions. He talks about, in a sense, the end of geography, because he says the world will have become so unified technologically and in other also, if you like, spiritually, that we will not survive unless we have a global approach.
But he also indicates that for the first time ever, humans, we can actually alter what it is to be human. Yeah. And I think that, again, is the other big challenge of this period.
The problem about that is that running right through is a very strong set of assumptions that are quite materialist. So when, at the very end of the book, you want to avoid your apocalypse, which he predicts, because he suggests we're about, because of the development of social development and technology, we're about to what he calls to experience the greatest discontinuity in history. Mm. Now, if that is the case, my problem about it, again, and I think about it, is that I have a real problem about the way in which he leaves out not just philosophy, but also political theory and political science, because there's no engagement with the imperial ventures that surround the Enlightenment of the 18th century from Europe. So when he's talking about Europe's engagement with China, for example, it's a bit superficial. But then I do take one point, and that is that the sweep of this book deciding to cover so much is impressive. It's a book that I would have as a reference book, but I would be putting it alongside Toffler and those kind of books rather than on the shelf with philosophy.
And again, he ends by having said that it's maps, not chaps. He ends up by saying basically back to chaps. Its leadership would be decisive in this period for all of the reasons that Michael...
So he brings... I mean, history comes back in that sense of
But if you look at
the
Ray Kurzweil, who's been around for a while, this guru saying that, you know, that you may have a merging of mind and machines where all things will be possible. He even gives us a year, 2045. Doesn't mention the month, oddly enough, but 2045
yes,
as the year in which the great merger. So we'll be going around. In other words, as you say, at that point, geography will be irrelevant, east and west. But, I mean, you know, this is fairy tale stuff, isn't it?
Well, one of the problems about it, I just happen to... Two things are influencing the way I'm approaching this book anyway, and that is a new book by Mukta on Enlightenment against Empire, which is about Diderot, people like that who critiqued and the 18th century. But the other is very much these programmes that we have had a connection between technology and geography, and that has been the one that enabled money to be moved in real time.
But this forgive me, Michael, this though specifically is a merger of technology and psychology. In other words, that you'd have newly functioning human beings. Bridget, what did you make of that?
Well, I'm not au fait with the real frontier of the life sciences now, but there is certainly a sense that we will be capable of altering almost our biological nature, the nature of the species. Yeah. And that one doesn't know where that leads. But it's very important then for society, for the social sciences, for the humanities to engage with what's happening in the life sciences now, and there is insufficient engagement with what's
happening.
But you
see, flow again in our own social sciences and life sciences is the obsession with quantitative material. This book is heavily biased towards, if you like, quantitative indices. In the appendix, he deals with the argument about of the measures of social development. But what if it went the other way? What if, in fact, you had a reflective, deliberative development? What if there was a recovery of some of the classical periods?
The deliberative has to engage with the quantitative. Yes. I mean, the strength is the long sweep with the quantitative
But
series.
He doesn't allow, Paul, he doesn't allow a role for ideas.
I don't agree. I think it's too reductionist, but it's not altogether exclusionary. Other set of heroes in this are, in a sense, the economic historians. He demonstrates the revolution in archaeology, really in the last 30 or 40 years, when we've got this long perspective. The economic historian's been doing the same kind of thing with all sorts of archaeological material, extending that history of humanity back those 500 generations. And I would certainly recommend this book to anyone for that sweep and for that length.
Absolutely.
But that engagement of the qualitative with the quantitative is one of its shortcomings. But it's underdeveloped rather than not stated.
But I mean, you balk really at his basic theoretical analytic framework, where he says biology and sociology explain the universal, we look to geography to explain difference. I mean, that is so clearly inadequate.
Well, these divisions have no meaning. These divisions have no meaning at all. If in fact actually he wants to avoid the apocalypse that he's predicting for 2045, it surely is one that will not be able to be... He will not be able to achieve this by keeping these rigid separations.
Well, forgive me, it's not an what's the opposite of apocalypse, Bridget?
singularity,
exactly. Yes. In other words, if Kurzweil is right and in 2045 we get our psychology technology act together, then there'll be something in our place, a post-human. Have you got your head around that, Paul, what that might be like?
I'm not quite. I don't think he has either. Yeah. Yeah. I think he does begin to approach some of the solutions to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think Fukuyama, the man who's invoked usually in these discussions, I think wrote a book on post a biological within the last 10, 20 years.
Mm. So and has retreated around, from us. Yeah. He retreated, of course.
Did he really? Yes. On the grounds what, Michael D., that...
Well, basically, that political events were happening all around him that he certainly couldn't ignore.
History caught up with him.
But the thing is about China, the sense here, What did you, I mean, I got the impression that, I'm not sure whether he's saying it or the sources he's quoting, namely Martin Jakes, is saying it, that in the second half of the 21st century, would be all confusion. China would have taken over.
I thought that there was a lot, between the East and West, there was a lot of zero-sum stuff, that it was one or the other. And in that sense, it's rather crude. He brings this kind of argument to the point where he talks about China displacing the East, displacing the West, and then he retreats from it.
Yeah.
And he said that that can't be a solution. So I think we've certainly identified that big weakness there, which is a kind of geographical determinism or essentialism of geography, which really doesn't... It actually, his own work is contradictory on that. And but it opens up an argument, and that's the great merit.
China faces very serious challenges and problems in all sorts of ways. I mean, the Chinese Communist Party wants... It doesn't want change. It wants to manage change, but it really doesn't want its power to change.
Well, I think that, on that, there is very little evidence that there is a return to Confucian thought in China.
Exactly.
I'm not in a position to judge that, but certainly I think that China is in fact capable of bearing the United States in terms of becoming a capitalist space.
You sometimes feel at times that the big ideological divide in the world is between those who put stability before everything else, like the Chinese do, and those who make some kind of space for human rights and qualification of that—that's a big divide, Paul, isn't it?
It is. And he identifies a lot of the weaknesses in the Chinese system, and brings then some of his arguments about migration, about state collapse,
and
to bear
also
on.
And also, certainly the indifferent, the fact the Chinese seem indifferent to what we. What others think. I mean, in a way, that's a big difference, isn't it? The West is more concerned with what others think of them.
I'm not sure the Chinese are indifferent. I think the Chinese Communist Party and the leadership and the Politburo may be indifferent.
I'm not sure they're that indifferent.
I suspect they're looking at events in North Africa with a certain a sense of concern.
I think there's one thing where I do agree with him.
We're talking across purposes there. I mean, indifferent to what others think of them. That in a way that perhaps the Chinese are, you know. In other words, they're saying, we'll keep order here, and we don't care what that takes. Mm. We don't care what others are saying. Listen, in keeping order, in making order primary, you're doing things we disapprove of. They say, we don't care.
But they're also very dependent and interdependent with the rest of the world,
and hugely dependent
on markets.
I think that they have a very pragmatic view.
Yes.
And I think there again, the missing model of empire shows up in the book. Effectively, the Chinese notion of refusing to overvalue their currency, of amassing huge amounts of American bonds, of buying into the United States. And where I do agree with him in many cases, it's interesting, the many examples he gives of empires that rose and fell in the history of China. Effectively, the model for understanding China is through the filter of empire. And I think that if you were to actually move that on into the present and look at the global economic and monetary system, you'll find that, again, it helps us to understand China and Africa.
Bridget, where do you see Europe in this grand scheme of things?
Well, for Morris, the battle is now, the battle lines are drawn between China and the United States. But in a way, if one looks... Europe had many empires, both empires on the European mainland and its imperial reach throughout the world. And Europe has now clearly retreated from empire and has managed through a level of cooperation across the EU member states to continue to position itself in a world where it continues to have a high level of social development. But again, as a part of the world, it is also faced with very real challenges. And it could... The euro... And what has happened in the global financial markets has very serious consequences, in my view, for the EU, and they're handling it really badly.
Mm-hmm. What are the big dilemmas that the Chinese face, or any kind of authoritarian-type society, Paul, is the inroads that that makes on creativity and on innovation as such. That's a huge problem for them, isn't it?
I agree, and it's a contradiction in their system. What they have to do to encourage that and to go beyond the, if you like, the copycat technology and develop something completely new contradicts the kinds of social, political, legal control that the Communist Party... That the working out of that is... You could say, to some extent, anticipated in this book, but it's going to be one of the great stories of our time. And in that kind of story, Europe still has a big role to play, because the way Europe can organise itself politically in this national way, yeah, has real relevance to the changes that are coming that he predicts.
In other words, the West, I suppose, has fared better in the last 100 years, has it, in terms of innovation and creativity?
I think there's a real problem about the West. For example, the West as a category about what it includes. Those of us, for example, my view is that the European social vision is under incredible pressure. I see in Habermas's recent statements a great concern that his rather larger view of Europe is very fragile, that Europe is fragile. Yeah. And actually the whole point of, for example, of making the case for a social Europe or a Europe that would be different was a Europe that would retain all these humanist categories that we're talking about, that would be able to draw on history and imagination and so on in a non-materialist way. That is evaporating as we speak.
What happened to Turkey, Bridget? What's the? Have they been finally rejected, or is that an ongoing story?
Oh, no. They certainly haven't been finally rejected. It is an ongoing story. Officially, negotiations between Turkey and the EU continue, but it's not clear yet what kind of Turkey joins what kind of EU and when. I would still predict Turkey will be a member of the EU.
That's a big one, isn't it?
Yes, I think it will be, but I can't predict the time frame.
I would agree. It's worth thinking about the difference it would make now were Turkey, in fact, to be a member, given all the changes in Middle East and North Africa. That's the way one has to think.
The question being what it will bring
in 20 years' time.
I think it brings a very valuable discourse into Europe as well. And I think, for example, we referred to it earlier about the human rights dimension. If you look at China and you speak about that you need to make gains in relation to human rights, the human rights discourse is in quite some state as well because of, for example, balancing the human rights that are the fruit of the Enlightenment with human rights that are there through revelation. Now, certainly in the case of Turkey, I think that the kind of thought that Turkey makes possible, the discourse that it forces within Europe, is quite an important discourse.
And he reminds us, he says at one stage that in the Middle Ages, the West was the Arab world.
Yes.
The cores shift. They shift geographically. They shift towards
This is a book you're saying that people should read. They'll find it useful.
Yes.
Lots of information, lots of material. They may disagree with certain aspects and certain slants
That's
in
good,
it. But,
yes.
But it's a book worth... This is what you're saying about it. You're recommending it.
Yes, irritating but valuable.
we've been discussing why the West rules for now, the patterns of history and what they reveal about the future, by Ian Morris, published by Profile Books. My thanks to Bridget Laffin, Michael D. Higgins and Paul Gillespie. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie. Till next week, bye-bye.